So B2B is a scary place to be as a buyer, as a recommender, whether you're on the committee or not. Whoever is leading that charge, they're going to be very, very cautious. But there's another asymmetry. So the buyer has got to be cautious compared to B2C. The buyer is also woefully ignorant because they can't be an expert on what they're buying. Otherwise, they'd be selling it. So they're buying it. By definition, the seller is an expert. So now they've got to trust one of the sellers to basically not ruin their career, right? You put your career in a seller's hands and the seller is a stranger and you know they're conflicted. You know they're being paid to sell you something. So you're in a quandary as a B2B buyer. Now, this explains one thing. Why do 80% of all B2B pursuits from the buy side with intent to buy end in no decision? That's the biggest question in B2B. That is the dominating question, right? It's the 80% question. It basically, if you can solve it, you can make your business five times better. You can go from 20 to 100, right? So how do you do that? Well, you got to recognize that the buyer has to trust one of the sellers more than they trust themselves. That's the benchmark. Because after all, they trust themselves as much as they know. They know they're sincere with regard to their own interests. They just feel woefully ignorant. Well, they know the seller might be an expert and they got to demonstrate they're an expert, but are they on my side? Can I trust them? And now we come down to just think, I got to trust them more than I trust myself. That's the bar.
Welcome to the B2B Digital Marketer Podcast, a podcast helping you to end your struggle with digital marketing, helping you to pave a new and better path to target and capture your ideal customer. Each week, we teach you how insiders and experts debunk the dreary and become engines of innovation. Now, here's your host, Jim Rembach.
Okay, B2B DM gang, you better get ready for a lot of one-liners that could change your life. That's one thing. Some really good stories. And really a very different perspective on what it takes in order to be successful with B2B cold calling. And while we may be talking about these being new breakthroughs, you're going to find that a lot of these things are based in ancient wisdom. Because I have Chris Beal on the line with us. Chris, welcome.
Jim, it is fantastic to be here with you.
Chris, now, so we're going to talk about trust. We're going to talk about behavior. We're going to talk about, you refer to middle brain. Some people call it a couple other different things. We're going to talk about sales goals. We're going to talk about the reality of a cadence, a lot of different things. But before we get into that, if you could, please share with the B2B DM gang a little bit about your experience and background.
So if I do it one direction, I'm a kid who grew up in the desert with no people. I had books and animals. So I learned a lot from books, because my dad, it turned out, was running a lifelong project that I found out about the day after he died. And it was a project to collect and read and understand the best that had ever been written and thought in human history. So my house was full of books growing up out in the desert, which is interesting. Not just any books, but curated books. And I grew up with animals, so I learned how to sell. Because when you're a seven-year-old kid trying to convince a horse to let you put a bit in its mouth, you got to sell something because it's bigger than you are. It's the essence of sales I learned from taking animals on emotional journeys so that they would physically behave like I needed them to behave when I was the youngest in the family and there wasn't a lot of help. So I grew up doing that, interest in math. It was, you know, some people, math is easy, some it's hard. I was one of those that it was easy for, and took up programming in 1968 in my high school, which on the same computer Bill Gates was using, thousands of miles away. We had access to it from a teletype. You know, you'd call it on the phone and it would go, and you put that thing into the cups on the modem. And so learned how to program back then, abandoned programming and did a bunch of other stuff, got a degree in physics, and then went back to software. When I was married, my wife was pregnant, I needed a real job. Getting a job in physics doesn't work. There's none of that out there. So I kind of went there like Willie Sutton said, you know, why do you rob banks? Because it's where the money was. And found out fairly quickly that I don't make a very good employee. I have issues, independent thought issues, I would like to think of them as. Some people call them other things. And so I left the aerospace industry that I'd gotten into, and I went and started doing software startups. I went to Bell Labs and wrote the Unix and C curriculum for Bell Labs. Most people probably go, what's Unix and what's C? But that's what our commercial infrastructure for tech is all built on, is offshoots of those two things. And I realized, hey, startups, you know, maybe you have a boss, but not really. And so just started doing software startups. And talk about somewhat, it was just to my strength. You know, I like math, I like programming, and I like selling. And I was a Fuller Brush Man at one point, knocking on doors, very, very successful. I became the top Fuller Brush Man in Arizona, I was told by my boss, in 3 weeks in the history of the state. I had a 92% door-to-close ratio. And it wasn't because I was so sweet or anything. I just figured, hey, you guys are doing this wrong. You're taking a two-step problem, trying to do it in one step. You're trying to hurry the animal up, and the animal's got to go as fast as it's going to go, not any faster. And I tell you what, a 42-year-old, you know, woman living in a house out in the desert who came from Ohio, she's not going to move any faster than she wants to move. You got to go at her pace. And I figured out how to do that. And so I just liked all that stuff. And, you know, one thing leads to another, I guess. And now I'm the CEO of Connect and Sell. And this is like the dream job for me, because it's a software oriented startup with humans in the loop. And I love how human beings work. We have about 260 people inside of our system who work with the AI to make it go. So it's got that really cool thing. And it's really obvious what it does. You push a button and talk to somebody. You know, I mean, it's not like, oh, it's got some complex, you know, outcome. The outcome is pretty simple, which is you talk to somebody. And as my wife said, when she used it, first she said, your product is the world's greatest weight loss program. It got my heart rate up to 160 and I didn't even have to move. But she said, secondly, I realized all my research was worth nothing, because I suddenly was finding myself having the undivided attention of another human being that I might be able to help in business and they might be able to help me. And she said, turns out that's everything. There isn't anything else. And by the way, she is a $5 billion quota carrier. So she knows what she's talking about when it comes to sales and business. And her point was, it all starts inside of each other's brains and guts and hearts. And, you know, it starts in a place where folks are trying to get to, and we deliver that place just like that.
Which in and of itself is, you know, part of the, you know, when I refer to the new breakthroughs in cold calling, you could say it's reverting back to, you know, the ways of humanity. And even when you were telling your story, though, and you were talking about your success that you had with, you know, the brush company and stuff, is you could assume it's like, well, you had all the answers way back then. And that's not the case either. I mean, because you're always uncovering and researching different methods, tactics, approaches that are just causing an even greater level of conversion and success.
Yeah, I mean, I just love finding out that I'm wrong. That's like my favorite thing in life. Somebody once asked me, what are you afraid of? You know, you're kind of a weird person. I used to climb big walls in ways that some people might not think are perfectly safe and stuff like that. I've always been very safety conscious in that world. That's why I'm still alive. But I also love finding out I'm wrong. And, you know, going out to that edge, that to me is the great delight. I think Richard Feynman wrote a whole book on the subject called The Pleasure of Finding Things Out. But when you find something out, what you find out is something you didn't know, therefore you were wrong. You might not have expressed any opinion, but whatever opinion you would have had was not correct, right? And it's like yesterday, I was talking to a CMO about something that we discovered that I was lucky enough to kind of run into that just showed that I was dead wrong about the purpose of cold calling, even with regard to approaching the market that you're in right now, instantly, right? So I would have said 10 months ago, maybe 12 months ago, that a cold call can lead to one of two great things. One is a conversation that builds trust. And the other is information about somebody, knowing whether they answer the phone or not, whether they have any interest in what you're doing, whether you should call them again, et cetera, right? So you get impact and then you get intelligence. What I didn't realize until we started measuring the opportunities, looking at the opportunities in somebody's CRM and Salesforce or whatever, and backthreading them to the conversations, that the most powerful conversations are the negative ones, not the positive ones, because they lead somebody to feel kind of relaxed, like I got off the hook, and they go to your website while they're talking to you. So you think of what you pay for Google Ads, tons, right? I think Google once told us, you're the only company in Silicon Valley that's never paid Google a dime. It's like, great. I know why, because we talked to people, but I didn't really know why. I was wrong. I thought it was the meetings. It turns out the conversation drives the activity that we would think of as being in a marketing inbound sense. It's just invisible. We don't see it. When we talk to somebody, cold call them, you ambush them, they probably go to your website right away. Now, why did you put that Google ad out there? You're hoping to get them to click and go to your website. But now you got somebody targeted going to your website. Truly targeted, like you put them on a list targeted, right? So that's an example of something that it took 11 years. 11 years of being at Connect and Sell before I realized our number one impact is not sales, but marketing.
Well, okay, so let's go back to what you said specifically about the positive versus the negative, and the negative are the ones. What do you mean by that?
Well, we have every conversation marked. It has a disposition. The user who's our user is a salesperson. They push a button. They talk to somebody. At the end of the conversation, they might take some notes. They might write a little teleprompter for themselves. How am I going to start the next conversation? Hey, Jim, we spoke back on August 4th. You said, you know, you had to jump into a podcast that you were recording, didn't have time for a conversation, right? That's personalization that actually counts because it's situational. So you do that, but you also set a disposition, busy, call back, interested, send information, whatever, right? Some of those dispositions are marked as negative. No interest, you know, no reason given, or no interest reason given. That's the most negative one. They actually told you why they don't want your stuff. But when they have a conversation with you where it has a negative disposition, those are the conversations that drive the most inbound pipeline.
Well, that's definitely a new breakthrough.
You wouldn't know it, but think about the psychology, right? You're talking to somebody and you tell them you're not interested. You don't really mean it, by the way. You tell them you're not interested because you have a simple goal when you get ambushed on a cold call, to get off this call with your self-image intact. So if the seller accepts your lame excuse as though you know what their business is, because you were dumb enough to tell them what the business is, and now you're kind of screwed, right? So they go down that path of we're all set. We're all set is the standard no interest reason given. Well, are they really all set? If they were really all set in the large, you would literally have no business. Your business would have dissolved, you know, years ago. I mean, after all, everybody is solving the problem already that you're trying to sell them a way to solve, or else you can't sell it to them. You can't sell something to somebody to solve a problem that they're not already solving. That doesn't make any sense. So we're all set as a universal correct answer, but it is of no value within moving the conversation forward. But it lets the ambushed person, the receiver of the call, off the hook. Well, they feel good about being off the hook. They just accomplished their goal. But on the other hand, you did go through the effort of calling them, and now there's a completely safe thing that you could do that back in the old days you couldn't do, which is you can go look at their website. And why not? Because it's a great reason to not go back to get on task. Because everybody talks about wanting to be on task, but nobody really wants to be on task. Everybody wants a break. So you've actually given them an excuse to do something useful. I'll just go click on this. So what that guy said, connect and sell. Oh, that's weird. Oh, this thing says, you know, not an auto dialer. I wonder what that is, right? Well, some of those people, they're now in a safe place and they'll come and fill out the form and say, yeah, it's okay to talk to. And those are the highest yielding conversations in cold calling.
Well, I dare would say, you know, I'm sure that's not part of the strategy process when it comes to you know, marketing and selling for B2B organizations. That absolutely it needs to be based off of what you just said. Now, okay, we're going to get deeper into some of those components and elements you were talking about, but I first want us to really establish something that you had said in regards to in B2B, that building trust is a business imperative. What do you mean by that?
Well, B2B is dangerous as a buyer. You know, B2C, I buy something, and if I don't like it, especially nowadays, right? I buy it on Amazon, I don't like it, I just gotta take it back, right? But even before, you know, I buy something big, right? So my example is always a Tesla, because I think they're pretty cool. So I buy a Tesla automobile, and I drive it home. It cost me $72,000 or something like that. By the way, I don't own a Tesla, but say I did. So I get it home, and it's funny, because you know, that night at dinner, I'm sitting there and I'm a little scoochy around in the chair. And my wife says, "What's the deal?" And I go, "Well, you know, my butt kind of itches." And it's like, huh. And then the next day it happens again. I go, "Wow, this is kind of strange. You know, I got this like itch thing going on." And the third day it happens again. And finally I go to the doctor and says, "I hate to tell you, Chris, you're allergic to electricity." And, you know, "Did you buy an electric car recently?" It's like, "Yeah, I did." He says, "You got to dump that thing. Got to get rid of it." So say I'm out 10 grand. I dump it for 62,000 because I was dumb enough to drive it home. So now I'm out 10 grand. Well, how bad is it? It's bad enough, but I can make up $10,000. Even I can at burger flipper wages like I pay myself, right? So eventually I make up that 10 grand. Do I lose my, I don't know, my dog, my wife, my future as a person? Nah, it's just money. Now, take that same $72,000 and spend it on something that makes my company's ass itch, right? A system that doesn't work with everything else, something that doesn't fulfill what the vendor promised, something that was a shiny object. I got a real problem. That's my career. That's my kids' college education. That's my retirement. It's my reputation. That's a problem. So B2B is a scary place to be as a buyer, as a recommender. Whether you're on the committee or not, whoever is leading that charge, they're going to be very, very cautious. But there's another asymmetry. So the buyer has got to be cautious compared to B2C. The buyer is also woefully ignorant because they can't be an expert on what they're buying. Otherwise, they'd be selling it. So they're buying it. By definition, the seller is an expert. So now they've got to trust one of the sellers to basically not ruin their career. Right? You put your career in a seller's hands and the seller is a stranger and you know they're conflicted. You know they're being paid to sell you something. So you're in a quandary as a B2B buyer. Now, this explains one thing. Why do 80% of all B2B pursuits from the buy side with intent to buy end in no decision? That's the biggest question in B2B. That is the dominating question, right? It's the 80% question. You basically, if you can solve it, you can make your business five times better. You can go from 20 to 100, right? So how do you do that? Well, you got to recognize that the buyer has to trust one of the sellers more than they trust themselves. That's the benchmark. Because after all, they trust themselves as much as they know. They know they're sincere with regard to their own interests. They just feel woefully ignorant. Well, they know the seller might be an expert and they got to demonstrate they're an expert, but are they on my side? Can I trust them? And now we come down to just, I got to trust them more than I trust myself. That's the bar. So all of B2B comes down to this one bar. Anthony Iannarino, in his book, Elite Sales Strategies, opens the introduction with a quote. And the quote is, "People buy from people they trust to make a decision they don't trust themselves to make." Now that, I have a problem with that quote, actually, and that is that he actually attributed it to me, and I'm not sure I said it. It's my name follows the quote, and I kind of go, "Anthony, are you sure I said this?" And he said, "No, last year you said this to me, and I wrote a book based on it." It's like, great, because I didn't write a book, and you're not lazy like me, so this is fantastic. But I think the quote is apt, you know, and if you listen to it carefully, people buy from people. That's number one. They trust. They got to trust them. But how much? Well, it's not just how much, but to do something, to make a decision they don't trust themselves to make. And that, I think, encapsulates all of B2B.
Well, and even what you're talking about, in order to even further add upon it, is Matt Dixon wrote a book about some research that they had done on B2B sales. And it came out in the book title is called Jolt Effect. And saying how most decisions are end up in no decision. Most sales opportunities end up in no decision. And if you look at the traditional sales processes and approaches, it's all about us learning how to overcome objections. And he said, that's not the problem. You can't keep going from that playbook, because that's not going to allow you to overcome the no decision situation. And this is where that trust component becomes so important. Now, how you deliver upon that, or the actions that are necessary, is quite different. And so there's a lot of things that people are doing. They're going down the wrong path. And one of them is personalization. And I think you have a very interesting take, again, a new breakthrough that people need to hear in regards to personalization. And really, what is it?
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I mean, I think personalization is great if you think about what it really is, which is being a person to the other person. That's personalization. And in sales, we tend to avoid being a person to the other person for two reasons. One is they are a means to our end, which is to make some money. So they're not a person anymore, even to us, right? So that's a bit of an issue. And how do you overcome that? The greatest salespeople alive overcome that actually spiritually. They overcome it internally. They realize I'm providing potentially something that can help this person and change their life. And I'm okay with this deal going whichever way it goes, right? So I'm going to try to use my time wisely, but not perfectly. If I use my time perfectly, then I wouldn't even talk to people I might be able to help. But I'm going to use it wisely. That is, once we realize there's nothing there, we're going to disengage or reengage later or whatever. So that's part of it. The other part is we want to compress time using automation. And in a digital world, there's a weird thing that showed up. And so let's go back to Gutenberg, right? Gutenberg, the magic of the printing press was you could make another copy of something with a screw jack and some ink. Before, you had to make that copy with a monk and a pen, right? It was 100,000-to-1 difference in efficiency in time. I could make a new page 100,000 times faster or something like that, some crazy number, right? Much bigger than the internet, much, much bigger, wildly bigger. That's why our civilization is, look at your background, look at all those books. Back here, I have a few. This is one of the houses I don't keep very many books in. By mass, I own more books than anything else in the world that I own, even cars. My cars don't weigh as much as my books. And I own a Ford Excursion. That's really saying something. So, you know, the desire to personalize at scale, it's so tempting to think, if I provide some information about you to you, I am personalizing, right? Hey, Chris, I see you're a fellow Sun Devil. I get emails like that. I got one today. I see you're a fellow Sun Devil. What are they telling me about myself that I didn't already know? What they're telling me for sure is they're not a sincere person who is on my side. I am 100% sure they're trying to use me. 100%. I am now, any doubt I had in my mind of what they're up to is gone. Since they don't know me personally and they use some information to try to claim an affinity that's not there, or maybe it is there. Maybe they're a Sun Devil too. I don't know. I was also an Arizona Wildcat. I'm all sorts of things, right? I'm a chimera. You ever try to cross a devil and a cat? Oh, actually, I think all cats have got that issue. But anyway, it's a funny thing that folks want to do this. It's the temptation to cut corners. It's the temptation to go the short way. Nassim Nicholas Taleb wrote, I would call it a tweet, but it was yesterday, so it's an X. I don't know what those things are called now. Like, what is that? I wrote an X. But he wrote an X yesterday that said, essentially, I'll butcher it, but it said basically, all attempts to take shortcuts are they're prone to failure. They'll lead to deep failure, because it's only in going the long way that we learn everything that's needed in order to make good moves, good decisions later, to know what not to do. And that's true in human interactions. We have to go the long way if we want to actually be in a trust relationship with somebody, because we've got to learn things about each other that need to be exposed over time, right? There's various levels of trust. I trust my climbing partner, Jim, literally with my life, literally many times. This is not figurative. This is like, this dude saved my life many times, and many more times his very presence, what he was doing, ensured my life. I could now fall and not die. Great, because falling could happen, or you'd be hit by something or whatever. So How do we get there? Was it like he wrote a little note that said, hey, I noticed that you climbed blah, 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 you know, whatever? No. We went first on a hike in the Grand Canyon. And then it was like, oh, do you actually like climbing? Well, we're both inexperienced. So we start doing some stuff together. We take a course together. And then we go out and do something where, you know, it's rain and thunder and lightning and we're scared and we have to actually like rise to the challenge together and look out for each other. That's how you get to trust with somebody, is through personal experience of a person. And they will determine perhaps that you're sincere, you're on their side, and that you might be an expert. And that in B2B is everything. So I think personalization at scale is a nonsense concept because it's not personalization at all. If I try to trick you into thinking that I'm on your side because I know something about you that I had a bot look up on the internet, well, come on, you got to call me on it. My bot says that you are like me. I got to say it like that or else I'm a liar.
So, I mean, as you're talking, that's again, one of the many mistakes that people make. And so the new breakthrough is, and even when you say long route, there's even different perspectives on that. Meaning, and we're going to get into this in a second, when you do a cold call, the first thing you say is actually a quick route to get the trust. So there's different to build trust. But before we get into that, another one of the common things that, you know, you see all over the place is that, hey, you should always be talking about and leading with value. But you say you should avoid value and avoid the value discussion. Why?
Well, in a cold call is an ambush. So you ambush somebody. Nobody gets a cold call and goes, oh, God, Jim, I'm so glad you called me. But they should. If they knew it was you and they knew what you're up to, they go, hey, this is going to be a great conversation no matter what. But that's not what they're feeling. They're feeling fear. When they get that cold call, they're feeling fear. They regret that they answered the phone and now they're afraid of what you're going to do to them. You are the invisible stranger. They are afraid of invisible strangers. By the way, we're all afraid of invisible strangers. If you don't believe this, try going somewhere unfamiliar, like a city that you don't know, in a part of it you're unfamiliar with, and have a power blackout occur. And the first person that you encounter, tell me, how do you feel about them? Are you going to embrace them immediately and say, help me, brother? I don't think so. You know, they're invisible, it's dark, and they're a stranger, and they're here, you know, as we always say, they're in your village at night. They're not bringing you Bud Light. They're not. They're here to change the demographics of your world suddenly and violently. So we are the invisible stranger. When we cold call, it's a terrible place to be. It's actually a great place to be because we know what the other person's feeling, fear. If we can relieve that fear in 7 seconds with tactical empathy, if we can show that other person, hey, you know, I see the world your way. I'm the problem. And then we demonstrate to them we're competent to solve that problem. Well, I'm the problem. I can solve it. That's easy, right? And we can get all that done in 7 seconds, according to Chris Voss and a bunch of FBI research. Then they trust us. So now that they trust us, that little bit, it's that little, that the door, you know, it's like having a door a little bit open. The difference between a closed door and a door that's open, a 16th of an inch, if there's light on the other side and you're in a dark room, is literally night and day. Literally a tiny crack in the door. That's what you got, that much trust. You can now see. You can see each other. You can feel each other. You can take another step. So your temptation is to take the step to value. Let me tell you how great we are, all the things we've done for other companies. What we do is fantastic, and here it is. The problem is you didn't take into account that person's motivation, which is still to get off this call, but they have a constraint. Everybody has a constraint all the time. We all need to protect our self-image. We can't let our self-image go. That's the most precious thing to us, is how we feel about ourselves, how we see ourselves. And very few people see themselves as somebody who's so, I don't know, coarse that they would just hang up on somebody who went through the effort of calling them. So now they're a little stuck. They want to get off the call with their self-image intact. So if you go to value, you've offered them the perfect exit from the call, which enhances their self-image. It's like the ultimate, you swing the door all the way over and you walk them up to the door and you say, leave, fly free, little prospect, go away, right? Because what you say is, you're saying, we provide this value. and they're saying, oh, thank God you said that. We're all set. We're all set, right? That enhances their self-image. I'm not incompetent. I'm not a person who doesn't do my diligence. I actually have paid attention to the problem you're talking about. And you know what? I've actually paid attention, done something about it. We're all set. What are you going to say? No, you're not. No, you're not. You're not set. It's like, that's the dead end of all dead ends, right? So you go to value and you're basically walking them out of the conversation. And it's a bad idea.
Despite what everyone else tells you to the contrary, right?
Right. Well, it's tempting. It's like when I used to knock on those doors of Fuller Brush Man, everybody said, sell that lady something. And what I said is, you know, ma'am, my name's Chris Beal. I'm your new Fuller Brush Man. You probably don't know what Fuller Brush is. I sure don't. And then I just stand there. I threw myself under the bus, right? Tactical empathy. And then I said, if what I've heard, and I don't know if it's rumor or not, is that we have some products that are good around the house, but you can't get in stores. I actually don't know if this is true. But if I were to go research and find one or two things that we carry that I really think could change your life, that'd be good for you. Can I come back and share them 5 minutes? No one said no. Not one person ever said no to that.
And you're still building upon that these days. You kind of said it in passing, but in different elements. But if we can't put a wrapper around the psychology of being the problem, you have talked about how we have to be aware of and come to the realization that we're the problem. And then all of the things that you talked about are kind of wrapped in that. So if you can just highlight and go through that psychology of being the problem.
Oh, you bet. I mean, the funny thing about it is this is why cold calling is hard. We know inside, we know we're going to be the problem. After all, if we thought we were going to be the solution, we'd just call everybody, go, hey, I'm the solution. They go, oh, fantastic. You know, where do I send the check? That's not how it goes down. So in fact, we are the problem. We're the invisible stranger. We've just scared somebody. It's much worse to scare somebody than to do anything else to them. It's terrible. No one likes to be afraid, especially afraid of something they don't know why they feel afraid of it. It's really bad. It goes back to that jolt thing. Folks don't like uncertainty. Oh, we just introduced a lot of uncertainty, including why do I feel like this? So the fact is we're the problem. That turns out to be the best part because we've got to do two things. And this is what I learned from Chris Voss, who was kind enough to teach it to me one night. I asked him, how long do we have to get trust in a cold call? And he just says 7 seconds. And I go, whoa. I mean, I actually jumped back. And I'm glad I didn't jump forward. I would have spilled his drink. But he's, you know, I kind of look at him like, what? So what do we have to do in those 7 seconds? He goes, oh, that's easy. And at that point, I looked at the drink to see if it was a second or a third. I mean, come on, how could it be easy, right? He says, all we have to do is show that other person that we see the world through their eyes, tactical empathy. And then we need to demonstrate to them that we are competent to solve a problem they have right now. And I said, well, isn't the problem they have right now me? And he said, bingo. That's why you can never fail in a cold call. If your goal is trust, you will always succeed by doing these two things as long as you do them within 7 seconds. At second number eight, you're screwed. That's why I have a podcast, actually. It's just about this. It struck me, and people who know me well know I'm mathematically inclined. It's like, well, wait a second. Are you saying that we could call everybody in our addressable market and in 7 seconds establish trust with all of them who answer the phone? And by so doing, effectively pave the market for ourselves and make our competitors have to come in and cause somebody not to trust us, which is an impossibility, because if you try to get somebody to not trust somebody they trust, they will not trust you. This is the essence of all political movements. This is how politics works, right? You get trusted and it locks in. It locks in and locks out, and it locks out everybody who tries to get somebody not trust you. Anybody who doesn't see this has not paid attention to kind of how people work, right? This is a tough one. So you can pave a market with trust And you can harvest that trust at your leisure, but you have to recognize the folks you're trying to go to market with, they replace whatever it is that you provide once every 3 years or 4 years. So in the good case, it's 3 years. That's 12 quarters. But they only consider for about one quarter. You got to catch them in their consideration quarter. So you got a 1/12 chance, 1/12 chance in a perfect situation of catching somebody who's ready to listen to you about value. But everybody's ready to trust you.
Okay. So in what you're talking about there, and in regards to that, you know, being in market, out of market, I've seen a lot of different reports on that. Some as little as 1% are in market for your particular solution. I've seen as high as 7%, but I haven't seen much over 7% in regards to in your addressable market who is actually ready. Is this merely just also to a potential risk of, trying to find the needle in the haystack because of that problem? Or how do we break through that so it increases our likelihood of actually, getting, more of those opportunities versus our competitors?
Well, it's built into the math of the world. 7-8% is the max. That's 100%. Because of this 3-year replacement cycle thing and the fact there's 12 quarters in 3 years, so 1/12 is roughly 8% change. And you got to assume you're not going to get them all. So if you got 100%, you get 8.66. Yeah, you're not going to get that. So that's why people go between 7 and 1. It depends on the replacement cycle. If your product has a 20-year replacement cycle, well, in 20 years, there's 80 quarters. So now you're down to 1/80. It's just a fact that the amount of time that folks consider starting down the road with 1, 2, 3, 4 vendors is generally about a quarter. And it's because of how budget cycles are built on the buy side. Nobody starts out and says, well, sometime this year, we'll pick some vendor to do, they don't do that. They go, look, we're going to have a process and we're going to look at who provides a solution. You got to get pretty desperate before you try to solve a problem a new way. That's an act of desperation. You'd rather just keep on keeping on. So at some point, everybody's looking around going, I guess we got to do something about this old whatever, this old Ford Excursion sitting out there in the driveway. Honey, we're going to have to sell that thing, get another car. So that's just kind of like built into the math. The replacement cycle determines the high watermark for who can be in market this quarter, but your market's still the market. And I call this sales myopia. So sales is built conceptually on the disposition of inventory. Inventory has a problem, which is it burns a hole in your pocket because it took money to create the inventory and you've tied up capital in a way that isn't productive again for making more inventory or expanding your factory, doing whatever, until you liquidate it, until you turn it to cash. Only cash can be used to make more products. And so I always have a problem when I make product faster than market can consume product, I get inventory. The whole idea of sales is we're going to have a dialable mechanism that uses effort and intensity and discounting and promotions and all manner of things in order to dispose of inventory. This is a side effect of capitalism. Capitalism, old capitalism, right? The one where you have factories, that's your capital, and they make things and you got raw materials and all that good stuff. And folks, remember, that's how we used to, run the world. Before software ate the world, you had to have actual stuff. And when you make stuff repetitively, you get a lot of copies of the same stuff. And the market doesn't eat those copies up as fast as you would like. You don't ever want to be starved for inventory. So you have sales. And what does sales do? Well, it's got to get rid of the inventory within the liquidation cycle to make your cash flow business work. And that tends to be about one quarter out. That is, you look at it and go, we better get some stuff done this quarter. We can't wait until 2 quarters, 3 quarters, 5, because the money's over here burning a hole in our pocket. In fact, it's burning up. It's like putting money out in parking lot and lighting it on fire. It is not a good idea to have inventory sitting around unsold. So we invented sales as a profession in order to make capitalism work at its most uncertain point, which is matching the flow of inventory to demand so the flow of cash can go back and make more stuff or make more factories, whatever it happens to be. Well, okay, so that's how sales works, right? Markets don't work like that. Markets buy to solve problems. So they buy to solve problems and they want their solution to be durable. They want the inventory. they want to still be using that thing 2 years from now, 3 years from now, right? So there's this mismatch. And that mismatch drives everything that is confusing in the B2B economy. The whole B2B world is confusing because I got to take care of the short term in the quarter, and I got to take care of the long term over 12 quarters or longer. And so what do? Well, we assign the other 11 quarters to marketing. But what we forget is, that's what we do. We go nurture them. And then it's, well, how? Well, send them stuff. Send them what? Well, content. Well, okay, that might have worked up to a point, but what we really did is we said assign the rep a territory, and now every sales rep has two problems, short-term, long-term, right? They sort of own the territory, so they'll nurture for us. But then we got into a world with less territories, less physicality, and we suddenly got this madness going on when nobody knows what marketing's job is. Marketing's job used to be simple. Nurture the next 11 quarters in order to support the salesperson in the field for their nurturing activities, which they can do by dropping off brochures and studies and this, that, and the other thing, and still focus on making the quarter. So this dynamic has gotten worse and worse and worse and worse to the point where now people talk about sales and marketing alignment as though it's an intractable problem. And it's not. It turns out it is a tractable problem. But the only oven that's hot enough to melt sales and marketing together is the cold call. Inside the cold call, sales and marketing come together. Sales gets an opportunity to engage, and marketing gets trust, which goes on the balance sheet as goodwill and lowers their cost and risk of doing what they do, which is the next 11 quarters.
Well, but people who are on the demand gen side of the equation of all of this could say, no. And people will even tout, we don't have any salespeople. We're all, inbound, type of sales. And we do all of this, lead gen and all of this stuff, using digital methods. But you're saying that's not going to work anymore either, or it's declining, or in some instances or segments or sectors, it's not going to work at all. Is that what I'm
saying? Right. I call this, it's like Gresham's law, right? Gresham's law of money says bad money drives out good. There used to be big issues with counterfeiting, still are, but people don't think about it very much, right? But like Isaac Newton, his job was to stop counterfeiting as best as possible for, England, right? That was his real job. That was his day job. His night job was inventing the calculus and that thing with the apples and the trees and gravity and all that stuff, right? Us physicists get to talk like that. We mean it. We're sincere about it. So, when bad money comes out, what's bad about it? What's bad about counterfeit money? It's cheap to make. That's what's bad. It's cheap to make copies of it. And therefore, the copies end up being in circulation. And the good money that's expensive to make retreats under the mattress. That's the history of the world right there. I mean, that's it. So now we have the same problem with information to buyers. Bad means cheap to make. Well, the printing press was still kind of expensive. I had to have paper and this and that. Now I can make a digital copy of a piece of content for exactly $0. Not kind of $0, but the marginal cost of the next copy of content to spam down somebody's eyeballs, supposedly, is zero. Whoa. Well, that means the bad, the cheap, will drive out the good. But what's the good? It's the scarce. And what's the scarce? Human conversations, because they're subject to a constraint of nature. You and I must both be physically existing, willing to talk, and now in communication with each other. Technology lets us do that remotely now, which means our territory doesn't have to be, my city, my block, whatever. But it doesn't change the fundamental, which is the high value always flees to scarcity. And scarcity is built in B2B only in the conversation.
Okay, so we talked about trust, we've talked about emotions, we've talked about, all these things in regards to the psychology piece. And you talk about emotional states being important, and we have to move people from different emotional states. Explain what that actually means when you start talking about a call that's supposed to be very brief to get us to an
actual. I know, it's crazy, right? I mean, the emotional states in question are, so we ambush somebody. Right? They make the mistake. They answer the phone. So now what? Well, we know their opening emotional state is fear. They're afraid of us as the invisible stranger. Their closing emotional state, we want to be commitment, if we can get it, commitment to attend a meeting, to get together with us and have, or somebody, and have a deeper conversation, deeper exploration. So how do we get them from the emotional state of fear to the emotional state of commitment? Because commitment's an emotional state. I mean, it's very powerful. When we believe that someone is committed, we change in our relationship to that person pretty much forever. I could tell you a story about how my wife and I, back when she was not my wife, had a conversation about this. And I just said, you know, I'll go first. I'll be committed to you for the rest of my life. You do whatever you want to do, right? That's how you change the game in the world of commitment. But you're hoping the other person's going to do that. So how are you going to get to commitment? Well, what's an emotional state that leads to committing to something? Interestingly enough, it's curiosity. Curiosity will lead to commitment because I'm committing to something that's unknown. That whole Jolt book is about the reduction of uncertainty. Well, there's a huge uncertainty that shows up in these conversations, and it comes with a certainty. The certainty is, if I agree to meet with you, you're going to try to sell something to me, and I don't like that. Nobody wants to be sold to. So that certainty is there. Well, how do I back that certainty about the uncertainty up? And what do I replace it with? I can't replace it with value. Value, when it's like, oh, the emotional state is I'm attracted to that. But then I have to say that I'm incompetent. I have to say I wasn't paying attention and that I didn't know. And I was waiting for a salesperson to call and tell me how to do my job. I can't go there. I can't go to that emotional place that says I'm incompetent. 95% of people believe they're in the top 5%. I got to be one of those people, right? So where can we go that will allow somebody to make a decision, a commitment to do something that they didn't anticipate? It's curiosity. Why else would it kill cats, right? Curiosity is what takes us to places where it's okay that it's a little bit uncertain. That's kind of the nature of curiosity, is curiosity makes the uncertain into a good, as long as there's enough curiosity. So now the emotional states that we can string together are fear to trust, trust to curiosity, and curiosity to commitment. And we can do all of that in about 35 seconds.
And everybody's sitting here and saying, what? I had to do a long form post. I had to do all these webinars. I had to do this, all these other things. And how can I actually just make it to be that simple? Now, I've heard you walk through it many different times. Also, I've heard you give some insights and information on some of the things and areas that you shouldn't go into when you start talking about these vital states. Getting to the point of to the meeting, I should say. But before we go into that, you talk about sales and the vital goals of sales, and that vital goal of sales, you really need to think beyond driving top line revenue. What is one of the other vital goals of sales that we need to be focused in on?
Well, the number one goal of sales is to gain information about the market that gives us competitive advantage. I mean, unless this is the only deal we're going to try to do, or the only time we're ever going to interact with either this person or somebody like them or somebody at a company like that, unless we're limited to that one, our advantage all comes from information over time. Whoever knows the most about the market wins in the market if they can apply that knowledge in a way that's of value to the folks in the market, right? One way to do it is to talk to the ones who might need you more than others. That's a way to do it. We call that, you know, targeting. Another way would be to recognize when it's not quite the right time and we should disengage. In sales, we call that disqualification. That's like the dumbest name in the world. All we're really saying is not now. Right? There's yes, no, not me, not now. This would be not now, bulk of the what happens in conversations. So, you know, we have all these outcomes. So the outcomes go into our world, into our head, into our systems, whatever, as proprietary information that gives us advantage. It's not available publicly. It's acquired in conversations. Oh, wait, my scarce valuable thing doesn't just deliver deals. It delivers the thing that's of real value, which is information. And information gathering is the number one goal of sales. And every great salesperson I've ever known is a sponge for gathering, organizing, using the information that they get from conversations in a way that's superior to their competitors. That's why you need to listen. I mean, you know, everybody emphasizes listening in sales like it's a trick that you use to get people to comply. That's ridiculous. It's not a trick that you use to get people to comply. It's the only way you can gather information that is yours and not anybody else's. I mean, that's the essence of competing.
Well, it's interesting because if you start looking about sourcing that information from certain places, a lot of organizations will say that, well, we gather that from our existing customers and existing clients, and then we feed that back into the process for sales and marketing. Now, what's the risk in doing that?
Oh, well, there's a few of them. I kind of come out of this world. Most people don't know this about me. I was considered kind of the king of electronic cataloging at one point. It was an accident. Somebody called me while I was washing my car, and I went and had a beer. And next thing you know, I'm in the electronic cataloging space, which doesn't say anything about bad about cars or beer, by the way. It just, those are both fine. You can keep doing that. Don't worry. You won't end up being a cataloger. The problem with that kind of work is it takes nuance and destroys it. It catalogs it. It categorizes everything. So basically, once you get down that road where you think you're learning all the stuff about personas and categories of problems and all this kind of stuff, all of which is useful for targeting, you start believing that it's actually useful for engaging. And it's not. It's very dangerous to engage from categorized information because you're making an assumption that can never be true, which is this person's problem and their perception of their uniqueness are subsumed by my categorization or my people's categorization of the world at large. Well, first of all, it's insulting. And insulting people is not a good way to get them to kind of come along and trust you, right? Treating you as a known, you know, companies like yours always need X, Y, and Z. And we know because it's kind of true. You do have to know a whole bunch of general stuff. I mean, very fine-grained, but widely applicable things, even to have a product. So products are, you know, they're an instantiation of a generic solution to a specific problem. That's kind of the definition of a product. Otherwise, we just do services and we consult and stuff like that. So when we take that information and we use it for targeting, fine. The idea of targeting is to reduce our cost of engaging to the point where we can determine if there's a reason to engage further. But once the cost has been reduced, we're fools to keep substituting the general for what we've just gained, which is the hyper-specific. We've just learned very specific things. Yesterday, I called somebody up who was an inbound. Inbound shows up on our website. I was intrigued. Neat looking company. I checked out the guy's background. One of the joys of having one of these iPhone things is I can be out micro prancing around on my deck, you know, getting a little old person exercise. And I go, huh, that's really interesting. You know, the guy lived right where I used to live and he's hooked up to some venture capitalists I used to know. And it's in a really interesting business, but they seem really small and it's B2B, but it's kind of funny B2B. It's kind of at the edge of B2C. I think I'll call him. Click, call. Didn't get him. Left a voicemail. Hi, this is Chris Beal. I'm CEO of Connect and Sell. I saw that you'd come to our website and asked to have somebody to talk to. I thought I'd reach out to you. I'm at 408-203-4321. Give me a call. He calls me back 8 seconds later, says, that's the weirdest voicemail I've ever gotten. Are you actually the CEO of Connect and Sell? I said, yeah, I am. He says, first, I got to ask you a question. What are you doing calling me? And I said, well, I've learned the hard way that at the CEO position, if you're not out selling, your ignorance keeps increasing. And you start to believe that your company's codification of the past is actually a description of the present leading to the future. And you know you're wrong. You know you're wrong, but it's just laziness. Like, I'm just going to accept this codified information as though it's the truth. So I got to go, you know, I have a fiduciary responsibility to kind of like know what I can within the boundaries of time and what little I have up here. So I said, I'm talking to you primarily to learn stuff. But he says, well, will you teach me something also? I said, sure. You know, we got a conversation going, right? And we talked marketing and the marketing impact of conversations and stuff like that. And yeah, they'll do a test drive and good things will happen. But my point is, we learn by engaging the market. When I first met, well, it wasn't the first day, but like the first time I ever went sailing with the woman I'm married to now, there was a problem on the mast. Now, she was a sailboat racer, but not an expert sailor. But she was willing to take me out in Puget Sound on this, whatever it was, a J80 or 60 or whatever it was. I don't know these boats, right? I'm like ballast, right? And you just sit me somewhere and, you know, it's good that they call your weight stone in England because I'm like that. I'm like stone, you know, you put me in there, it's like ballast, right? Well, there was a little something on the mast that she wasn't sure about, like its position or whatever, I don't know. And she basically runs toward the mast. And I thought, that is the way you solve problems. You get close and then slow down and engage in a rather leisurely fashion now that you've gotten yourself some time by getting close to the problem. Well, you get close to the problem when you sell. You're really close to the problem. And now you can engage in a leisurely way in order to have you both understand, does it make sense to take a next step? Which is all we do in sales, is we just ask the same damn question over and over. Does it make sense to take the next step? Well, we've got to both learn something, because if we already knew it made sense, then we wouldn't bother to meet to see if it makes sense. We're learning from each other, new information, right? So that's what sales is primarily about.
Well, but when you start talking about that, and again, a lot of the common information that is out there talks about, hey, you need to have a sales cadence. You need to do all these things. But so what is actually the truth behind an effective sales cadence?
Start with a conversation. It's pretty simple. A sales cadence can't work until there's trust, because the trust problem is the problem in B2B. And so if I just start banging you with emails, I'm actually reducing trust with each. The more clever the emails are, whatever, the more trust goes away. It's actually like a trust destruction machine. We think we're, quote unquote, warming up the person for a conversation. What we're actually doing is saying, I'm doing cheap stuff because I don't want to do the hard thing, which is calling it. So I'd rather do something cheap. And I have a bot doing it. You can call it what you want, but my sequencer's a bot. And I'm going to have my bot blast stuff at you. And we're not going to call it spam, but, you know, we both know what it is, right? So the problem with sequences is digital sequences are known in advance to be cheap, because digital by definition is cheap, because making a copy of a digital thing is cheap, right? And while there might be a war out there between the spam filters and the spam penetrators, and by the way, that's what these sequencers are built on technologically. I know, because I was there at the beginning of each one of them that's of any size. And the answer is always like, what's your secret sauce? Oh, sending more emails without getting caught in spam filters. That's the tech, right? So what's the sales impact? Well, at first, there are folks who are susceptible to, because of their own trust, internal kind of the way they do trust, that are susceptible to those email sequences. They're always there. So you burn off all of them really fast because the email sequence is easy to do. And then you end up in a funny place, which is, why isn't this working? And then there's A-B testing and more A-B testing. And by the way, A-B testing sequences is mathematical nonsense. Trust me, it makes no sense. Your sequence has multiple steps. The steps can vary in time and space and what's in them. By the time you're done, you're A-B testing saying, I believe that this atom somewhere in the universe is different from this one. Well, there's 10 to the 80th of them out there. You can't A-B test your way to the truth. It's like putting monkeys in a room to see if they can become brain surgeons. It just doesn't work. You got to start with something that is known to work for really old, reliable reasons. And an old, reliable thing is a conversation that builds trust. After that, sequence away. Start with this one. Thank you for our conversation today. The only email subject line that sincerely gets sent and will be opened every time. You'll get 95% open rates. They're wonderful. Folks will come to your website that actually told you no. Great. Thank them. They took their time. Even if it was 10 seconds, they talked with you. Thank them sincerely. That's something you can do with a low-cost mechanism because you showed that you were willing to endure the cost of talking to them yourself. You showed yourself worthy. You pulled the sword out of the stone, or at least you wiggled it a little bit. You gave it a try. You grunted, right? So now you can go digital. Digital, to be effective, depends on trust and trust to happen depends on interpersonal interaction, and you only got 7 seconds.
Chris Beal, awesome insight. Talking about new breakthroughs, but based in ancient science. Thank you for sharing. How does the B2B DM gang get in touch with you?
Well, there's a couple ways. One is chris.beal@connectandsell.com. That's pretty easy. I might miss it in all the email, though, because I get a lot. Another is LinkedIn. I'm not that hard to find, but I might miss it in all those inbound email. Hey, let me sell you something right now. So, but give it a try. That might work. If you actually want to learn more about this stuff, go to the Market Dominance Guys podcast, where Corey Frank and I have 185 episodes in which we endlessly go on and on about this theory of getting this stuff done. And then if you want to really have a good laugh, you can read the book I wrote with ChatGPT called Market Dominance, A Conversation with ChatGPT. Trust me, the book is not very good because it was written by a robot. That was kind of the point. But it was written in only 2 days. So, you know, all those things are likely to work. You can also call me. I'm 408-203-4321. I try to answer the phone a lot. I tend to be pretty busy, just like everybody else. So sometimes I pick up, sometimes I don't.
Chris Beal, thank you for sharing your knowledge and wisdom, and we wish you the very best.
Thank you for joining us. Go now to join the B2B DM gang in the B2B Marketer LinkedIn group, where you can connect with other B2B DM disruptors and get access to our B2B DM cheat sheets, checklist, and guides. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, please help by going to iTunes to rate, review, and subscribe. And share the show on all of your digital platforms. Be sure to tune in next week for our next episode. And always remember, you can automate your lead capture, but you must lure your lead.